Thanks, Dave.
You're welcome.
Let me start out by just going over what we'll cover today in the workshop. If you want to go to this site, idratherbewriting.com/learnapidoc, and in the first little section, click Workshop Activities. This gives you the plan for what we're going to do today. You can't see? Oh, a bit bigger? Okay. My intent is also that you can go to this page as well, so hopefully you can see it. Basically, we're going to go through three different parts. First, we'll have an intro to API documentation, where we'll get into each of the core sections of a reference topic, endpoints and requests and responses, and you know what's expected in each of those. Then we'll jump into part two, Open API and Swagger. The Open API is a formal standard for describing APIs, and Swagger is one of the most common ways that it gets rendered and so forth. And then we will look at non-reference content in API docs. So this is the stuff that is not the reference topics. It is, hold on, sorry. I am recording this. I just want to make sure I'm not like have it too high of a level on the recording. So I just want to turn that down. The non-reference content refers to stuff like the authorization and getting started tutorials and the workflow between setting things up and how the endpoints might interact and so forth. More of the how-to and the tutorial and the conceptual content. All right, and along the way, we have various activities. So in the first section, we're going to do a few activities related to making requests and using Postman and so forth. And then we're going to jump down into using the Swagger editor. We're going to use a visual modeling tool called Stoplight to work with it. And then we're gonna do a GitHub workflow. If you look through this course, I also have some sections on like publishing tools. But since last night we spent a lot of time talking about publishing tools, I'll only talk about publishing tools that are very API doc specific. And we'll probably talk about that, I'm not really sure where, maybe in part two. Okay, is everybody online? Has everybody accessed the network? Okay. Any questions before we get started? I did have a list of things to download. That's great if you've already done that. If you haven't, don't worry about it, because there'll be time to do some of it between this. We're going to take breaks at each part, or after each part. You have like a 5-10 minute break. If you have questions and so forth, you know, this is a workshop, it's interactive. The whole point is that you come here to learn, and the idea of a workshop is that you actually do hands-on things. It's not just like a lecture. And so that's why I've got these activities. My experience in workshops is that even the simplest technical exercise becomes magnified with all kinds of complexity, glitches, different setups, different machines, different surprises. So I try to keep these simple. At the same time, there's a lot that we can do to increase the complexity on some of them. The other challenge with workshops is that there's such a variety of knowledge. You've got one person who's practically like an API designer next to somebody who doesn't even know what API stands for, right? So this challenge is always it's frustrating, because for one person things might be moving a little slow, and another person they're moving too fast. So just be patient. If you are like, hey, I already know all this stuff, we'll probably get to parts of the course where there's new material. And if you're new and ramping up, you have the comfort of knowing that, hey, a lot of this is online. I've got this course that I've been working on. My initial goal with this course was to like publish it into a book, and I'm still heading towards that direction. I'm refining it, I'm getting feedback, but this space is changing fast. Like, I wrote a tutorial on, for example, using pull requests in GitHub last year, and then I was looking at it this year, I'm like, crap, I have to rewrite everything. So it's a challenge. All right, any questions before we jump into things? Yeah. Or let's start here and then you.
The address for the workshop page, I've got your basic page up, but what's the workshop address page?
This is, if you just click this right here, you go to it. Learn API. So let me start back at the blog. If you go to idratherbewriting.com, yeah. Click API doc, mm-hmm. Expand this first section, workshop activities.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and I also have links to some of the slides. The slides are online, and we'll jump into this first section, intro to API documentation. Oh, you had a question back there, sorry.
Same question.
Anybody else have? Okay. All right. I am recording this, and I usually publish the recordings later, so if you want to check it out. But again, this is where you can access things. I just covered that. Let's jump into a little bit about APIs, application programming interface. You know, what does that mean? APIs refer to, just as a general definition, it's the way two different systems interact. You have two different computers talking to each other, and they use certain language and modes to communicate, and we'll dive into that later. But first, let's talk about the market for REST API documentation. You're all here probably because, well, I shouldn't make generalizations, but the market for REST API docs is pretty good, especially if you're in the Bay Area. It's hot. I mean, you will find lots of jobs if you have good API doc skills. And we're talking six-figure incomes. This is a good space to be in. The traditional side of TechCom, where you're just documenting graphical user interfaces, you're not really working in developer doc spaces, there's still lots of jobs in that area, but it's not as in high demand. Technical skills are becoming more and more the reality. And why is API doc so uniquely kind of uniquely in demand? Well, with graphical user interfaces, you have an application that you can use. And a lot of times users, they can figure out stuff on their own, right? They just tinker around and they figure it out. It's not the case with an API doc. There's no user interface for somebody to use an API. The user interface is the documentation. That is the user interface. So companies who want to have a good product need a good product interface, AKA docs, right? They need good documentation to sell their product. So the doc is the product interface, and that's why companies say, we need somebody who can write good docs because we need to have a good product. And a great site, Programmable Web, did a survey about, you know, what do developers want in API documentation? And they found not in API documentation. What do developers want in APIs? At the very top of the list is complete and accurate documentation. It's more important to developers than any other part of it, right? So given this sort of recipe that the product or the documentation is the interface, it's the most important element to developers, there's a super high demand for it. This is a good space to be in, and it's a good space to develop your skills to be able to deliver in this space. All right. There are lots of different types of APIs. Web APIs are kind of the most recent and most common APIs. But APIs are not new. They've been around since, I don't know, whenever. Java APIs, C++ APIs, PHP APIs are what I call library-based APIs. And with the library API, you get files that you download and incorporate into your Java project, for example. And then these files allow you to, you know, do additional capabilities that you didn't have before. That is the old kind of style of API documentation. Web APIs do a similar thing, but across the web. And web APIs have been growing exponentially. This chart tracks their growth since 2005. I think one of the first APIs was one with eBay to allow like people who had listings to update all their product pages programmatically and so forth. So they've been growing exponentially, but web APIs or REST APIs are the most common. And part of the growth is fueled by this larger paradigm of the web, where we have a services mashup. We have lots of individual services, and they all interact. This is kind of the scary thing about the web, as well as the neat thing about the web. For example, on my blog, and most people's blogs, if you want a comment feature, you might implement a service called Discuss, which interacts with its store of information through different APIs, or a poll service, or Facebook comments, or other kinds of things. You tie them together through these APIs. And the web is this kind of loosely coupled web of APIs that are interacting. The scary part is that we don't always know how these different systems are going to interact, and so you have a lot of like things that are built without full knowledge of how they're going to work with other things, and so that can lead to sort of these scenarios of complexity, but that's sort of another topic. All right, so what is a REST API? I like to think of it as a gear here. If you think of one system on the left, another system on the right, and you want them to interoperate, to interact, the API is that gear in the middle that allows the two to communicate. If you think about like something as simple as YouTube, you have a YouTube video on your web page. That you don't actually have YouTube on your page. You've got calls that are being made to a YouTube service for a video, and then a response that returns the video back to your page. So that works the same with Facebook and other kind of systems. You know, you don't actually have Facebook on your page. You have comments that are being pulled from a Facebook API back to your site. Or Twitter. Twitter's a great example. You've got how many Twitter clients that tell you your latest followers and stuff. Those are all driven by APIs. You've got one system that's interacting with another. All right. Another example might be something as simple as your calculator. Now, this is probably not the best example because a calculator wouldn't use an API. But let's say you push a button, 8 plus 9 equals. Well, when I push a button in an interface, behind the scenes, there are functions that are kicking off and executing processes and then returning information. With this calculator, all those are on my computer, but with an API, the same kind of processes happen through requests to the external services on the web. You've got UIs, you press buttons, a call goes out to a service, brings back information, and presents it into the UI. So even if you're not, if you're using any kind of like user interface, a lot of times underneath is a bunch of APIs that are powering it. And that's why this documentation is geared towards developers, because they're creating these interfaces that are powered by APIs. To give you one example, I was working on a project at work, and this API had two components, one for administrators and one for like more of like the end user experience. And the administrator UI had a bunch of calls on how to set things up, how to create these different, I'm pausing because I realize it's an unreleased project and I can't actually be specific about it. So it's got these groups of things that you can create and manage. But it's just an API, and the intent is that a developer would create a user interface with buttons. You click, you know, new group, and executes an API request to the group endpoint, creates a group, comes back, and then it shows, you know, that information, which is then displayed in the user interface. I actually have a full screen mode here. Here is a model of how this request and response works. You have some computer, some application. It could be in Ruby, it could be in anything. The cool thing about web APIs is that they're pretty much language agnostic, meaning they don't have to be made in Java or PHP. You can make a request in any language. It goes out to some server in the cloud, some API service, which can also be in any language. That service could be in Java, it could be in C++, whatever, right? You don't have to have a continuity of languages. The protocol that is used is HTTP. So the same protocol that you use for visiting web pages and so forth, hypertext transport protocol that we type all the time when you go to a website, is used to send this information as well as return it. So it all just boils down to requests. How do I make the request? And what comes back, the response. If you think about the web, a lot of this is second nature because the web itself follows REST. When you go to I'dRatherBeWriting.com, you're typing an HTTP request using, you're actually using a GET method. You're sending a URL, you're plugging it into a browser. It's going to that page. The page says, oh, here's the information, here's the response, sending it back. And the browser just makes it look pretty, right? There's, if you look at the code, you just see that it's returned a bunch of HTML. But really, the same sort of principle is what powers a web API. Now let's give a sample sort of scenario. Let's say that I wanted to make a biking app. Let's say that I don't know why it's being cut off at the bottom there, sorry. Let's say that I'm making a biking app because I want to know if it's windy out, how cold it is, how much the wind is blowing before I get out biking, right? This is what you want to know. If the speed is, if it is really like a 29 mile an hour wind, you don't want to be out biking unless it's behind you. So how could you do this? Well, you would find a weather API of some kind that would have this information. You create a user interface, you add some buttons, and they make calls and return the information. And here's a quick little demo. It doesn't quite have the same, of course, I click it and it doesn't go to, okay. Let me, okay, I think I've got it. Oh, maybe I just had it here. All right. So if you're looking here, you can see I've got this code on a page, and I don't have a fancy UI. But I've got a button that says check wind conditions. Now, when I click this button, it's going to go out to a weather API and retrieve information and pull it into the interface. So the, right now, the wind chill is 54 degrees Celsius. This is Sunnyvale, by the way. Wind direction, so forth, is this degrees. And the speed is not really that windy. Now, in this case, this sample uses JavaScript, specifically AJAX, to make the request. But you could use the same sort of scenario in any kind of user interface. A more complex example might be a whole weather site that has all kinds of information. You go to weather.com, you know, all that stuff is retrieved through APIs. Even if you go to a sports site, you go to ESPN and you see all the stats about what the score is and who's got how many rebounds and how many points and field goals, you know, nobody's typing that into a table. That's pulled from an API. So all this information is on the web is driven by APIs. Okay. So let's check out a sample API. And the approach that I'm kind of taking here is that first, we look to see how a developer would kind of use an API. And then when you get this sense of how a developer would use an API, it naturally leads you to understand like what elements they would need to document it. So if you are at the workshop activities page, let me close a couple of these, where it says activity one, explore an API, there's a couple of weather APIs we're going to check out. One is one of the simplest weather APIs that I could find, and then one is one of the most robust weather APIs. So this first one where it says Mashape weather API, click that, go to that, and we'll check it out first. Make sure we're on track here, yeah. Now, Mashape is kind of this marketplace of APIs and so forth that, you know, supposedly you go through and you see what APIs are of interest to you, and you can consume them and so forth. But it's kind of very simplistic in my experience here, especially this weather one. And there we go. Okay, so this is made by a developer, and they have a very specific template.
I really hate to stop you, but I'm having a hard time seeing the screen, and I'm not able to get to where you're at on my computer.
Okay.
Can you do the 1, 2, 3 for me, how to get there?
Yeah, okay, all right,
sorry.
Let me back up right here. Are you able to get to this page where it says Intro to API Documentation?
Intro to REST API is where I'm at.
Make sure.
Back to learn API doc.
Yeah, learn API doc. Okay. Expand the first section. Uh-huh. Click workshop activities down at the bottom.
Okay, so that I did not find.
And oh, you didn't see that? Hit.
Mine's not loading, so I don't know.
Try spinning. Refreshing. Mine didn't load, and then I refreshed.
Yeah, try refreshing. Sorry, I added this little page yesterday. Or just type /workshop-activities.html after it. Or Command Shift R. I told you we'd run into technical glitches, but I didn't think we'd get to it that early.
Okay.
Who? Now it takes a while for this page to load. I think because the thing about networks is that they work fine when you test them out individually, but then when you have 30 people in the same space, all going to the same page, making the request at the same time, it's different. So it might take a minute for this page to load, but if not, you can hopefully see it here. I'll try to make it a little bit bigger before it loses things. There's not a lot here. This API has three endpoints: AQI, weather data. AQI stands for Air Quality Index. But I just wanted to pull this out because it helps to start simple. What are the basics of API documentation in a most basic example? And let's look at the weather data one. This is a better endpoint. This has a brief description below it. Gets the weather forecast by longitude and latitude. You have a parameter section. It tells you what type of parameters these are. They call them URL parameters. Other people might call them query string parameters. But there's two parameters, lat and LNG, latitude and longitude. And it gives you a sample value. Now with this site, the idea is that you could enter in latitude and longitude of your choosing, click test endpoint, and you actually get the response. Another section here is request headers. So this is also part of the documentation. What needs to be submitted in the header to authorize it. And here there's a special key. This is the API key. And it's going to populate by default if you were logged in and so forth from your application. On the right, there's a couple of other components. The endpoint definition, as they call it. This is the URL that's going to be submitted. This is a get method. In other words, it's just retrieving information. It's not creating it. There's a sample of how to submit this, and it's formatted in curl. And then a response, a sample response of what you're going to get back. And what's the format of it. So these different components, the endpoint name, description, parameters, the endpoint definition, method, request example, response body, this is kind of the core of what is expected in an API reference topic. Yeah.
Are URL parameters, one, is that a key value pair? Is that considered a key value pair? The URL parameters?
In this case.
My next question is, are those parameters the same then as like the key value, the field and field descriptions for the requests?
The field and field descriptions for, where are you seeing that part?
I was asking kind of in general.
In this case, these are query string parameters, so they're and I'll jump into this in a minute, but they're added in the URL. And are they key value pairs? Yes, but not a key value pair like in JSON. They are going to be added, if you look at this sample request, they're going to be added with a question mark followed by like lat equals one, and then ampersand LNG equals whatever. But there are different types of parameters, and we'll dive more into this later. There's a request body parameter that might have a JSON snippet that has each of these as key value pairs in a more traditional format. And there's another type of parameter called a path parameter. So one challenge in API documentation, and I'll be jumping into this more later, is that there's not a standard for how people call things. They call these URL parameters, but another developer might call them query string parameters. Another developer might just call them params or something. And this sort of variation in terminology is rampant. I was working on an API at my work that a developer wrote. They just kind of did their own templating and formatting. And one group decided to call them methods. Here are our API methods. And another group working on another API, different area, you know, not crossing over in any way, called them the API interfaces. And they're referring to endpoints right here. Some people call these objects or resources. You know, there's a lot of variation. So there's a strong need to standardize how people approach this documentation. And that's where the open API thing will come in. But we're not quite there yet. We're just kind of getting the basic shape of what's required. Notice here in the top also you have a fancy little feature that lets you see how to submit this same request in lots of other ways. The default is curl because it's kind of something anybody can run in their browser. Wait, where are we? Ah, okay, the curl. But if I switch over to Java, it will say, hey, this is how you would make this same web request in Java, or Node, PHP. Now these are auto-generated, and I'll show you how you can auto-generate them as well. Whether they're that useful, not really sure, but developers do like easy code snippets. Okay, any questions, thoughts? Now let's look at this second workshop, or the second link, the Aeris Weather API. Now, somebody once told me they felt the Mashshape Weather API here that I use as a basic example is kind of like a toy API. And I agree. In fact, this AQI endpoint consistently does not work. But this Aeris Weather API is a real API. And this is one I was actually very happy. They reached out to me and gave me like a free API key because they just discovered that I had used them as an example in my course. And they were like, that's awesome. We're giving you a free API key. Well, because the other one expires every 2 months, the free one. If you look at this one, there's lots of different APIs. They even have like a Lightning API. So they've got different segments of them. And right away, even if I jump into the reference part, jump into endpoints, you can see that they've described them a heck of a lot more, right? So you've got a much more extensive description. And if I jump into forecasts, for example, you can see that each of these parameters has been described. And now they like to adopt this convention of putting a little colon before things. And you've got another area that's like, hey, these are the supported parameters that are all defined. They've got supported filters. So this is very robust. You've got a core endpoint, but then you add all kinds of stuff to it to configure exactly what you want returned. And this is sort of a, when you start to work more with APIs, you'll realize that there's a lot to the design of an API. Sometimes developers will have like a couple of endpoints and 75 different parameters on how you can configure it. Other times, they'll have 75 different endpoints and almost no configuration. There's lots of people that you could probably read about best practices with design, but you'll have an opportunity to work with different models and provide input. Anyway, so this shows you that endpoint documentation can be a lot more robust. We've got response properties. And this is one that, you know, I don't really throw people into it at the start because there's a lot here, right? it's hard to take it in one glance. But we've got these same sections, parameters, examples, response, properties, and so forth. Okay. We are going to make some requests with some of these. Now, with both of these examples, you need API keys to make the request. But whenever I try to do this in the past where I like tell people how to get the API keys, it's way, way more work. So I'm going to give you some API keys that you'll use, and they should just work. We're going to first start out making some requests in Postman. So if you have not downloaded Postman, you should do this now. You can go to Get Postman. Whoops, not Get Pocket. Get Postman. And click Download the app. There's two versions, or actually there's three versions. Postman for Mac, Postman for Windows, Postman for Linux. So raise your hand if you have not set up Postman, because I do want you to make sure you've got this. I'll give you just three people. Sweet, okay. Go ahead and start setting that up while I give you a brief overview of Postman. Postman is a REST client, which basically means it's a way that you can submit requests in a nice graphical user interface that looks kind of like this. And you can see the responses. It makes it really easy. You don't have to use Postman. There's other applications. One of them is curl. You could submit stuff straight in the command line, and I'll jump into that in a little bit. But this is probably the more common one, and Postman is probably the most popular REST client. There are at least a dozen different ones you could use. There's a nice one for the Mac called PAW, P-A-W, but it costs $30 or so. And probably has functionality that you might not even care about. So go ahead and open up Postman. Yeah, I realize it's a little small. I'm trying to make it bigger. Yeah.
Are Postman and curl then, can they be used interchangeably?
Or? Yeah, you can use them interchangeably.
Okay.
I'll talk more about curl in a little bit. In curl, you're going to be submitting the parameters. You're specifying them in a more like programmatic way. But yeah, I believe Postman probably submits a lot of stuff using curl in the back, in a way you can't see. I'm not really sure. But if you are at the workshop activities, we're going to try something here. Skip down to activity Postman client and click this run in Postman button. See what happens. See if you can get it to populate your Postman client with the information that little script there contains. If you click it, it will say open with Postman for Mac or Chrome. I don't know why it's prompting me for Chrome. But hopefully if you're on Windows, it'll say Postman for Windows.
Yes.
And then when you open it, it should populate this left section with a little place that says workshop, and it will have a bunch of calls. So try that and see if that works. I'll be excited if it does. By the way, I really like Postman, and I'm part of this podcast, and one of my co-hosts actually got us an interview with the founder, and he was telling us about it. And I had mostly used Postman as a way to do testing of requests and so forth. And he kind of unraveled what else the platform can do. They even have it. They even have like a doc hosting solution with a one-click kind of button. The way they envision Postman is that developers spend time building requests in here. They set up the parameters, and then you should just be able to export that into documentation. It shouldn't be like a separate tool. This is where you define things. Yeah.
I don't know about other Windows users. Some Windows users are not. It's not opening for them. Can you download straight now?
The Chrome.
Okay.
Extension.
Yeah.
All right. If you're a Windows user, it's not opening. Try the Chrome extension then. I thought they abandoned the Chrome extension. Oh really?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Try that. Or you can plug this in directly, but I think it's going to be easier if you do the Chrome extension. Sorry, it's the downside of not having a PC is I sometimes become blind to them. I actually have a PC at work, but I hate turning it on. That's the truth. It wouldn't work on yours? Okay. Well, I'll give you a couple minutes. Raise your hand if you don't see this little workshop section with pre-populated stuff so I can know. Okay, 6 or 7. And how many of you are trying the Chrome extension one?
I'm trying to find the extension.
All right, search for Chrome app, Postman client, see if you can find it.
Can you download the collection from the website and import it?
Yes. did I make that? No, I did not make
it. I don't know if you can like right-click on it, or is that run as Postman like a whole?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let me, okay, so I should have had this, I did have a link here previously, and then I took it away. Let me see something. Okay, so I will update with the link here. Give me 1 second. Okay.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah. And I'm on a Mac and I'm there. Thank
you. Is anybody else getting a message like open with Electron?
Open with Electron. Wow, you're special. I don't know.
Nice.
All right, so give me a second here, and as soon as something updates, I'll show you how you can import a link. Okay, so if you are not able to click this little button, then refresh this page, refresh the workshop page, and you'll see a thing that says, from this link.
Wait, okay, so we're gonna go back to
go back to the workshop page. I just updated this page, so it says, populate Postman from the run in Postman button or from this link.
Okay, well I don't have those pictures at all on the left-hand side of my screen, and I'm in workshop.
You don't have these pictures? You must have an ad blocker. You have an ad blocker? Anyway, refresh your page. Refresh your page. You should see the link. I just added it. Right-click and copy the link address. No? It's not showing up? Try what is it? Control-R to refresh, and it bursts the cache of the page. Okay. How about another browser? Open another browser, same link.
Should we just copy that link to the browser and try it?
Yeah, copy that link. No, not into a browser. Okay. If you want to import the link, go to import and then import from link and paste that link in here. This is
Import from, I'm sorry. Yep,
okay. All right. You're going to click. Don't actually click the link. Copy the link address. Go into Postman. And do you see an import button up here? Import. You see an import from link? Paste this guy in here. Click import. See if that works. That does work? Okay.
I'm not to import, but I don't have the link. because I didn't have one copy.
Anybody else have?
Can you help her? She's not getting the link on the page. She needs to refresh the page somehow, or maybe open a new window.
Did you add a link to?
Yeah. Collections? It's her. There. There's five requests in that workshop collection. All right. Okay, that's looking good. Does anybody else need help? Is anybody does?
That link, are they supposed to download?
No, they just copy the link address.
Okay.
And go into Postman. Click import.
Okay. That's an interesting address. I'm going to copy that.
When you click import, and then there should be a tab that says import from link. Sweet. So what was the deal?
I don't have it on the left, and I don't have what he's got.
No, sorry. I've got some other stuff here.
Yeah.
Yeah, I should have clarified. I should just delete these other ones, actually.
Everybody else good?
I think so.
Yes?
I think I made a request, so.
All right, so let's take a look at some of these requests. First of all, the run in Postman button can be pretty helpful. There's actually, while I'm on this topic, if you look at the Postman network, I don't really know how you get to it from their site, but if you look at this, they feature a ton of people who have implemented this run in Postman button in their API documentation, and you can see how they do it. It's kind of cool. But it's perfect for a getting started tutorial because you can help a user suddenly have their own instance of all of your API requests right in a client that they can use. So you might just think about that. The way that you generate that button, which you know doesn't work for everybody and has problems as we can see, but by and large, the way you get it is super simple. Once you save your requests in here as a collection, you click this little arrow to expand it, click share, click embed button, it gives you the code. You just paste it, or you get this link. So it's that easy to share things. And the idea of Postman is that everybody, and this is where their paid model kicks in, but let's say your whole team has an account, and you're sharing a collection of requests that are configured a specific way, and you're all in sync, right? And then as a tech writer, heck, you've got like what you need to document right there. So. Anyway, but we're not really using team sharing and syncing. Now this first one, get the weather in Flagstaff, Arizona, is using the Aris API. And let me just give a kind of a small tour of how you get around in this thing. In the main text area is where you'll paste your endpoint definition or the URL. To the left of it, you choose the method. You can see there's, wow, I didn't realize there were that many methods. I thought there were only like six. I've never heard of lock, prop find. Maybe these are some custom ones. Anyway, get, post, delete are probably the most common. But this is a get request. On the right, if you click params, it expands all the parameters. Now, the parameters are also added after every question mark. It says question mark client dash ID equals and then ampersand. That's how you connect query string parameters together in the browser. But it also shows them broken out here so that you can easily edit them. And here we've got a client ID and a secret, which are populated from that link. So you know normally you would have to sign up for those and you know figure out what they are. We've got a limit and a has now. These are some filters from the Aris Weather API about how to specify the time and what you want returned. let's see, anything else worth calling out? As far as headers go, Normally you would pass the API key into the header, but a lot of times you also just put it as a query string parameter here. And if you click send, it's making the request, and then down at the bottom, you will see the response. There should be an option here to specify what format of the response. If you wanted to just see it in plain text, you could. You can switch that around. You can see it in a pretty way, which just means formatted, or raw, which would be minified. So pretty much you want to keep it as JSON and pretty. And it shows you what's coming back here. This endpoint is showing us, I believe, the weather in Flagstaff, Arizona. Let's say that we were, looking for a nice climate to retire or something. This returned the information. You can see what is coming back here. As a developer, this would be of interest to you. What am I getting information that's going to be useful in my scenario? Now go ahead and click send. Did everybody get an actual response back? Awesome. Yes. Okay. Now let's go to the next one, migraines in Tennessee. This is just another example. This is using a different Eris weather API. They actually have some kind of migraine index that where you can see if, like, where you're at is susceptible to migraine headaches, which is kind of crazy, huh? But if you had migraines, this would be cool to see if, like, maybe there's certain weather conditions that high pressure, low pressure, I don't know, that contribute to it. So click send and take a look at what information you get back here. I'm going to dive into the different, the form of this information, but we've got arrays and objects and arrays inside of, or objects inside of arrays and so forth, key value pairs, and there's some things to know about the format that we'll get into later. Let's click weather in Ecuador. Click send, and we can see what the weather is like in Ecuador. And if you expand the parameters, you can see that here we've got a limit of 1. A lot of stuff is just specified directly in the path. We'll talk about this later, but here, Chimborazo, Ecuador, comes before the question mark. That means this is a path parameter, and the rest is a query string parameter. We'll get into that later. But here you can see what's coming back. But essentially, this is what API documentation is about. How do I make the request, and what comes back? And that's essentially what you're documenting. Now, the last two are from the MashShape API, weather API on MashShape. And here, if you click params, you'll see that there's just two, the latitude and the longitude, which I believe is configured to Sunnyvale. And you could add more parameters. You just add them there. But what's different is that the headers now has an x-mashape key, and we've got an accept parameter that says, what kind of information will we accept in the request? Well, we will only accept JSON. A lot of times this is sort of passed by default, I think. If you click send here, for some reason this seems to return it in JSON. I think it's per in text initially, so switch to JSON. And you can see what's coming back and the information. not only do you have to document, a sample response, a sample response and a sample request, but in your response you should document each property. And the allowed values and the data types, and we'll talk more about that. All right, and let's do the final one. Get the weather forecast. This is a different endpoint, just the weather one. And this one actually does just return in plain text. And this is configured to Singapore. All right, so the way this works is pretty easy. You would come in here, you click the plus tab to create a new one, you would enter that information, you could save it. When you choose to save it, if you want to keep it, you can put it in a collection. It just sort of prompts you with that. And this way you can have all the endpoints for your documentation stored here. You can go through them. You can actually do a lot of testing from here. For example, if I expand this and click run, this is going to run some tests. So this is a way to see, oh, hey, did the developers change a bunch of stuff? Or for testers, probably more accurately, to run through all of these different scenarios and requests and make sure things are working. So you can imagine if you were doing testing, you could do some pretty powerful stuff here if you had hundreds of different combinations and you wanted to quickly see if there were errors. All right, any questions? Postman, pretty awesome. Now, one other thing, if I forget, I want to mention it here first. To get information in here, if you click import, you'll notice that you can also import an OpenAPI file. They call it Swagger, but that's just the previous name of OpenAPI. So if you once you have this definition of an API, you can import it here, drop it in here, paste it in here, and it will populate the same thing. In fact, it will even add it in a more formal way. Let's see, I think I have it here. Nope, I may have deleted it. Anyway, it will put more of a description and import the descriptions of things and show it more conceptually. So, all right, questions? I don't know. Maybe. Right. Have you run into a size limit?
Well, I'm just wondering because the run feature sounds really cool for what we need to do. Because we have to use a different set of software. And so our files can get huge.
Yeah. So how many tests can you run in there? I do not know. I've actually never used that run feature myself. I was just sort of exploring it and realized that they'd added it. There are lots of tools to do unit testing. By unit testing, we mean you're testing like one specific part of something, not a comprehensive, holistic sort of test, such as a test of an endpoint. There's another tool called RunScope that's very popular. And we're going to talk more about Stoplight. But basically, any API platform that tries to offer lots of services is going to offer testing because you've got the endpoints in there. And they can build services to test them. So it's not really a unique Postman feature. They just have been adding it to try to have parity with others. All right, let's talk briefly about curl. Curl is a command, a CLI command. What does CLI stand for? Command language interface. Anyway, it's what you use in a terminal to submit the same requests. I like to use iTerm, but if you have, on a Mac, you can go to something called Terminal. Let me open that too. Terminal, it looks highly similar. I should probably just use that. All right, or on a PC, you can go to a command prompt and do the same thing. Now, this is a part where you kind of had to have curl installed if you're on Windows. It's a pain to install. I don't know why. It's just, if you have it, great. We'll just do one quick exercise and walk through this. But curl is often used because when you think about the sample request that you'll need to make, how are you going to show that, right? The Postman thing is neat, but it sort of organizes these different components in its own interface. Curl is nice because it gives you a code snippet that you can easily paste here and people will understand, oh, dash H, this means this must be passed in the header. Dash dash get, oh, it's a get request, and so forth. So the way curl works, let me do a quick copy and paste here of this code, and I'll come into, let me come into, this is a little more readable. Just paste it and I get back the minified response. It's not going to prettify it. You can actually, there are ways to prettify this in the command line. You have to like do a pipe and do some formatting and so forth, but you can set it up if you really want to use curl. Curl is frequently used by QA teams because they can build scripts that will then push a bunch of different endpoints into the command line and do testing in a more robust way. But you could also take this same response, for example, right here, if you wanted to prettify it, and go to, I'm sure you've seen this site if you work with JSON, JSON pretty print And you could uncompress it, see what it looks like, and so forth. Now, curl has a lot of different parameters. Here are some of the most common. It's not just used for testing APIs. It's used for a lot of different things. But the dash I means in the response, I want to include the headers. There's actually, you know, like a status request that comes back, maybe other information. Dash D, let's say that you have a JSON file in the request body and you've got it stored in a file rather than like as part of the curl command. You can reference that file. Dash H means in the request header. Remember back in Postman, there was this headers section right here. Well, these same headers are specified with a dash H. And dash X, post, would say, hey, use the post method, which will create something, so forth. So there are like hundreds of these different curl commands. And if you really get into curl, you can become a power player and be like, oh, I've got a really advanced thing. But at the end of the day, you've got curl provides a language agnostic way to show how to make a request for your API. So if you wanted to, you could make that request. But since not everybody has curl installed, and you've already seen what it does with the Postman client, I'm not going to press it. Yes, Dave.
Can I ask for, because this is something that's super useful to me, can you show how to get curl request from Postman?
How to get it from Postman? Oh, yeah. Oh, I didn't even talk about this. Okay, yeah. So let's come into Postman. Let's go back to, I don't know, go to any one of these. There's a sort of subtle feature in Postman, which is kind of crazy because they've got a UI with all kinds of functionality that I don't even realize until it's pointed out to me sometimes. Over here on the right where it says code, click code, and this shows you how to make this same request in 20 different languages. One of them is curl. So if you click curl, it'll automatically format that for you. So you can work in Postman, and when you're ready to say, oh, give me the curl snippet for my docs, you just copy this and paste this into your terminal command line, I get back the same response. Or if you wanted JavaScript, remember the Ajax one that I was telling you about with the get the wind speed? If I click jQuery, I now have a code sample that I could use directly on my web page. Basically, I mean, you have to know a little bit about JavaScript, but not more than a novice to make this work. I mean, I made it work, right? I'm not a JavaScript programmer, and basically plug it in. Or if you're in any of these other languages, Java, you can see that every language has its own way of submitting a request, which is leads us back into this that part of the mass shape display that showed the different requests in different languages, or the same request in different languages. You can automate that here. And a lot of tools that maybe you might use to host your docs would automate that. In my view, since any developer could basically just get the same information here, it doesn't seem that essential to provide all these to people. But a lot of times, the way most APIs are delivered is that there's a language agnostic API, and then it is accompanied by various SDKs in specific languages. The SDK is how you implement the API in a particular language, usually. So you will have, for example, a REST API for making groups or whatever. Accompanying that is probably like a Java SDK that would have like specific Java commands like this and other code that a Java developer would need to implement that API that they could download and incorporate into their project. It's still making requests with the REST API, but it's got all the like language specific code. So anytime people talk about an SDK, it's tooling to support an API. And it's usually language specific. It's sort of a broad term though. It could mean like a whole kit of tools, but generally, and we'll jump into this later. Generally, it's targeting the language that you think your users will actually use. Any other questions, thoughts? All right, a little bit about the response. So JSON stands for JavaScript Object Notation. In the past, before web APIs, one of the most common APIs was one called SOAP. It was also a web API. So it's not as if it's like a library-specific API. But SOAP had a very specific format, and if I'm remembering correctly, the responses are usually in XML. And a lot of the early web APIs have had an XML response. Problem is, when you get an XML response, it's hard to plug that into a web page, right? If you've got a web app, you've got a web page, what you need is JavaScript. And JavaScript object notation is readable by JavaScript. So the JSON has basically replaced XML in a lot of scenarios, not every scenario, right? Banking, financial, regulatory might still use XML. But for the most part, the response you get back is JSON because it works on the web and it plugs into JavaScript. You access it using JavaScript. It's very easy. It's a whole different tool chain with XML. But JSON has two main types of information, an object and an array. An object you recognize with the curly brace. So this first one is an object with two key value pairs. You separate each one with a comma, set them off with quotation marks. An array is a list, and you recognize that with brackets, square brackets. You can have objects as items in the array. You can have an array that contains objects, you know, so you mix and match these if you want. But just be aware of these two different information types.
Tom?
Yeah?
Is an array also called an enumeration?
Yeah. But they're shortened to enum. An enum is an array that has a finite and definitive list of options. For example, let's say that the array contains only two possible values, highest or lowest. So the enum is like, hey, only these two values are going to come back. Whereas a general array could be like any kind of item in the list. And enums are typically capitalized, full caps. All right. One thing that is also very cool that you should know about is in Chrome or Firefox, you can log something to the console. Right? When you make a request, and if this is kind of refers to more working in JavaScript, you can log something to the console. You put like console.log/ and then what you're logging there. And I'm not going to get into the code details of this. You can see it more on my site. But here I've got a request that is being made on the page. And you can't actually see it unless you open up the JavaScript console, view developer JavaScript. And let me magnify. Oh, I don't know if I can magnify this part. Let me see. Yeah, there we go. You can log this object returning this the response to the console, and it looks like this in this sort of expandable, collapsible thing, and you can see what is coming back. So a lot of times if you're developing and you're trying to make sure that you're actually getting a response back, you can log that response to the console, expand it, see what properties are coming back. It's super useful. So just keep that little trick in mind if you're starting to use JavaScript. Dot notation is how you access different parts of that response. So usually if you're using that JavaScript AJAX method, it returns the response in an object that it calls data. And then if you want to access like subnested properties in that object, you use little dots. So data.query.results.channel.win.speed refers to the query object, which has a results object nested in it, a channel object nested in it, a wind object nested in it, and a speed object nested in it. And that is how JavaScript accesses different parts of the response. You have a question, or are you just kind of twiddling your thumb? Okay. I already showed this. This was the sample that's coming back. All right. why don't we take a 3-minute break here, and then we'll jump into documenting these different endpoints. This first part, you were kind of learning how to use an API like a developer, right? You were making requests, getting responses, a little bit about, you know, how those might be displayed on the page. Now we're going to switch hats. We're going to go through each of these sections, but we'll take a 5-minute break.